Thanks, Andrew. You've got a sermon outline on the inside of your new sheet. It'll be helpful. As Steve mentioned, we're doing a one-off topical sermon today on giving. And we'll have a question time at the end if you have any questions left over. But I want you to know the reason we're doing this one-off topical sermon on giving, it has nothing to do with our budget this month. We organised this sermon about 12 months ago. And the reason we preach on giving once a year is because, you see, if Christians are not being challenged in how they handle their money, money has a way of starting to handle us. If Christians are not consciously in control of their money, money starts to control us. And the reason money controls us is because that's what idols do. You see, when we idolize something or serve something, as Jesus tells us in verse 24, that thing ends up controlling our lives. It will tell us what to give up, what to sacrifice in order to appease it. I'll give you an example. You see, when people idolize their work, right, their work will tell them to start spending less time with family and less time with church in order to appease the God of work. So before we even begin, let me ask, what control do you think money has over your life? What control do you think money has over your life? And it's not an easy question to answer. We're going to see why a little on today. But to answer that question, I want to give us three control questions, three test questions, indicator questions. Now, I didn't come up with these questions myself. I stole them off Tim Keller. And they're not exhaustive questions. All right, you can ask yourself any number of questions, but I think these three questions are enough to rattle most of us. So question number one, remember what we're trying to figure out? What control does money have over us? Here's the first indicator question. How do you react to rich people? Do you resent rich people? Or do you perhaps feel superior to rich people because, well, you would never spend your money as extravagantly as they do? If that's how you react to rich people, then you are controlled, at least in part, by money. Money is telling you what to think. It is telling you to judge rich people. You see, Jesus says, do not judge, lest you be judged. Money says, you're a better person than the rich because you're less extravagant and more generous than them. Question two, how do you respond to poor people? Do you look down on them and declare that they should just get off their lazy backsides? Or as one of our politicians recently said, go get a better paying job? Right? If so, you're controlled by money. The gospel says that you are just as sinful, yet just as loved by God, as the poor are. Money says you're more blessed or a better steward than the poor. Question three. How do you treat your money? Are you the kind of person who is always looking for opportunities to be generous? Or are you instead looking for excuses to keep your money so as to protect your lifestyle? If so, you're controlled by money. You see, Jesus never said, look after your lifestyle. But money says, be anxious about your lifestyle. Be anxious about what you eat and drink and wear. Now, I don't know about you, but I fail on all three of those questions. Money has a certain level of control in my life. I don't want that. So if we want to change, if we want to no longer be controlled by money, enslaved to money, we need Jesus' words in this passage. What Jesus shows us in the second half of chapter 6 is how we can ensure that money has no further control over us. If that's something you want, then come with me to Matthew chapter 6. Now, our passage begins in verse 19 with these famous words. Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. Now, the context of Matthew chapter 6 is that these treasures Jesus is talking about is money. Okay, we see it in verse 24. You cannot serve both God and money. But a treasure is basically anything of which our heart says, I must have that thing. And if I don't have that thing, then life is more miserable. So an example, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. What is the treasure in that? It's the Ring of Power. And what do the ring bearers call the Ring of Power? They call it My Precious. And they will do anything, even kill their friends, to get that treasure, that precious. And so what we're looking at today, look, it covers any idol that our hearts might fashion. And so if, by some miracle, money is not one of your idols, then just replace one of your idols with what we're talking about today. But the specific topic we're looking at today is the idol of money. And the reason money is so easily treasured by humans is because it can meet all four of our motivational drivers for life. Matt's going to put the first screen up, if you don't mind, Matt. Scholar Dick Keyes has identified that all humans look for happiness or satisfaction in life in one of these four areas: comfort, acceptance, security, and power. We've talked about these before. Now, remember, these four things, they're not sinful. That's just where humans look for enjoyment in life, and different humans look in different places. Where sin comes in is if we're looking to things other than God to get these things. So, for example, next screen, please, Matt. Comfort, money can buy comfort. It can buy those things that we enjoy in life: food, nice food, entertainment, or gadgets. Money brings acceptance. Thanks, Matt. It can buy us status in life so that we can be approved of by that person or that group. Money brings security. It leads us to control our own financial destiny, so we don't need to worry about how we're going to pay our bills. And finally, money brings power. The US elections are coming up next year. It almost always comes down to a certain extent to who has the biggest war chest, doesn't it? He who has the pesos has the power. Thanks, Matt. Now, the reason it's important to know what motivational driver you look to in life is because it will help us identify exactly how money might be controlling us. And the reason we need this extra help is because of point two. Humans are completely blind to their greed. Completely blind. That's what Jesus means in verses 22 and 23. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? See, what Jesus is saying here is that greed is an eye sin. And what does he mean by that? It means that what your eye goes after, if your eye goes after money or materialism, what it ends up doing is it blinds your heart to it. So you don't even see it. Luke says a similar thing. He uses the same phrase. If you can just put the verse up behind us. Thanks, Matt. Luke 11, verse 34. Your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eye is healthy, your whole body is full of light. When your eye is bad, your body is full of darkness. Thanks, Matt. Greed blinds our heart to our own greed. This is why Jesus says, watch out, because you might be greedy. You notice he never needs to say that about adultery. He doesn't say, watch out, you might be committing adultery, as if to say, oh, wait a minute, you're not my wife. You know, you don't need to say that, do you? But greed stops us from even asking whether we're greedy or not. I mean, let me ask you, when was the last time you even asked the question about your lifestyle, about your spending habits? Have you ever asked a Christian friend to keep you accountable to your money and your spending? See, most Western Christians, we don't even think about this. You know what we do? We find a really rich person and we compare ourselves to that really rich person and we say, well, we're less extravagant, we're more generous, so we're okay. Friends, that's the power of money. Greedy eye stops our heart from even asking the question about greed. So if we are going to have any hope in breaking money's control over our life, we have to ask the question. We have to ask the question, in what ways might money have control over my life? Now, the good news is that asking that question is half the battle. After we've asked that question, the next question is, how then do we store up treasures in heaven? But before we can figure that out, we need to know what treasures in heaven are. And my view on this has actually changed in the last 12 months. My view on a lot of things has changed in the last 12 months. I don't know if you've noticed. Previously, I went with the commentators on this one. So I looked up five commentaries on this, two on Matthew and three on the equivalent passage in Luke. Wilcock on Luke 12 was silent on what treasures in heaven are. Thanks for nothing, Wilcock. But Bock on Luke, along with Stott and Carson on Matthew chapter 6, all tell us that treasures in heaven refers to godly behavior, righteous deeds. Right? And that's what I used to think. Treasures in heaven are the things that God treasures, and he treasures us behaving in a godly way. Now, while I'm a huge fan of godly behavior, don't get me wrong, I now think all those commentators are wrong on what treasures in heaven are. You see, treasures in heaven refers to our ultimate treasure. And our ultimate treasure is God. Well, God and Jesus, but Jesus is speaking in this passage, so he's referring specifically to God. We can include Jesus in this as well. That's what treasures in heaven are. It's God and Jesus. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus is a treasure in heaven because we're talking about how Jesus is our ultimate treasure a lot these days. It's actually in the passage. All right? Nowhere in this passage does Jesus even hint at godly behavior. He doesn't talk about it at all. But in verse 24, Jesus compares slavery to money with slavery to God. In verses 25 to 32, Jesus compares relying on money with relying on God. And in verse 33, Jesus says, seek God's kingdom. One of the commentators actually got really close. I.H. Marshall on Luke, he said, treasures in heaven is not obeying God. He went against the other commentators as well. He said, treasures in heaven is trusting God. Very similar to what I'm saying, which is treasures in heaven is pursuing God himself. And to be honest, what Jesus tells us in verse 24 makes zero sense if treasures in heaven are godly deeds. Makes zero sense. See, the thing Jesus is telling us to pursue in this passage is God himself. And herein lies the secret to throwing off money's control over us. All right? In verse 24, Jesus says, if you don't want money controlling you anymore, if you don't want it accessing your thoughts and changing your behavior, then find a better slave master. If you don't want the slave master of money, then find a better slave master. Have a look at verse 24. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now, we need to note up front that Jesus is not suggesting in this passage that you and I might have treasures. We might have something that is precious to us. He says everyone has treasures, right? Everyone has something they look to for meaning and satisfaction in life. Treasures are a given. We have no choice in that. The only choice we have is in what we choose to treasure. And what this means is that if we stop treasuring one thing in our heart, it will just get replaced by another. And so the only way to ensure that the idol of money is not replaced by another earthly treasure, another impotent idol, is to replace it with our treasure in heaven. And this is what we've been preaching here since last year. All right? The only way to stop our heart from desiring a sinful or idolatrous thing is to replace that desire with a stronger desire for something better. We've been preaching it for a while, but in Men's Convention 2 weeks ago, I actually got a title for this. It came from Mike Rader. Mike Rader said he got it from Tim Keller. I think Tim Keller would have got it from Jonathan Edwards. It's called this. It is called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. That's what we've been preaching here. Right? The only way to expel an unwanted desire or affection is to replace it with a better one. The only way to stop treasuring money is to start pursuing God and Jesus as our ultimate treasure. Now, the million-dollar question is, how do we do that? How do we pursue God? How do we store up God as our ultimate treasure? Well, the answer, look, I hope you're listening to this. This is the million-dollar answer to the million-dollar question. The answer is to focus on what is good and enjoyable about God. That's what we do with any treasure, isn't it? Right? The reason we treasure money is because money can buy us good and enjoyable things. If we want to treasure God, store up God, we need to focus on what is good and enjoyable about God. And the way we do this, please understand this, it is not by just learning new things about God. At men's convention 2 weeks ago, Dr. John Woodbridge told us a story about one of his colleagues, a Bible college lecturer. And this lecturer, he took all the psychological reports of the students before they entered college and he compared them with their psychological evaluation after they left college. And what he wanted to realise, what he wanted to determine, was whether 4 years of full-time Bible study actually changed the psychological profile of the people, and in particular, whether they actually delighted in God anymore at the end as opposed to the beginning. Did they delight in God more? And what he found was that 4 years full-time Bible college had zero effect on people treasuring God. And I can attest to that from my 4 years at college. Now, what this lecturer did find was a small smattering of students that did treasure God more at the end than at the beginning. And he went and interviewed them and he found the one thing they all had in common was that these students meditated on God's word every day. Or as John Woodbridge called it, said, these students took Psalm 1 seriously. Blessed is the man who meditates on God's word. Now, meditation is not just learning new things about God. All right? It is letting those doctrines impact our hearts. And the research is in. The only truly effective way that you and I are going to treasure God more next year than we do this year is by meditating on his word every day. Contemplating how God's awesomeness affects our lives. At men's convention this year, and it's brilliant, this is the handout. In the handout, there is a 2-page spread on 17 different ways that we can meditate on the scriptures. I've photocopied this. There's about 40 copies up the back. If you want more, if they all go, everyone should take one. If you want more, come and see me. I'll photocopy more. Take it home. Use it. Because meditating on the Word of God is the only way we are going to treasure God and Jesus more. Let me give you an example. All right? Let's meditate on the Bible. What topic are we looking at today? We're looking at treasures. How do we find the answer to our treasures? How do we make sure we're going to be treasuring the right thing? We look to Jesus. We look to Jesus. What did Jesus do with his treasure? You see, before Jesus was born as a man, he had infinite treasure. He had heaven. Right? Jesus had infinite comfort. He had 10,000 times 10,000 angelic attendants. Jesus had infinite acceptance. Every single one of those attendants wanted nothing more than to serve Jesus. He had infinite security. He was the Son of the Father. And he had infinite power. He was the Lord of heaven. But as he was sitting up in heaven, he looked down to the earth and he saw the church. And he said, imagine if I could get Barbara. Imagine if I could get Fran. Imagine if I could get Val or Clyde. And he said, if only I had them, then my life will be worth it. And I will give anything to get them. And he did. The cross is where Jesus lost all his treasure, where he suffered an eternity in hell in just a couple of hours. And Isaiah 53 says that when Jesus saw the result of his suffering and he saw that he was left with nothing but Barbara and Pat and Val and Clyde, we're told he was satisfied. Jesus said, totally worth it because I have my treasure. Friends, the way to expel the affection for money from our heart is to realize money will not die for you. Instead, money will ask that you die for it. That's what an idol does. It demands you sacrifice yourself for it. But when we realize that we are God's possession, we are Jesus' precious, of whom he said, I am willing to die in order to get you. Friends, when we realize that, Jesus starts to become our ultimate treasure. And money's control over us starts to wither and die. When Jesus is our ultimate treasure, many things start to happen. But I'll give you just three. Number one, we no longer look upon the rich in judgment. We don't care about their money. We don't care what they do with it. Money's not important to us. Number two, we don't look upon the poor in judgment. In fact, we'll start to use our money to help them. And number three, we will start to give our money away in embarrassing quantities so that it's affecting our lifestyle. Why? Because money isn't precious to us anymore. Jesus is. We will actually use our money to pursue his kingdom and his righteousness. So friends, who do you want to serve? Treasures on earth or our ultimate treasure in heaven? I'm going to give us a few moments to reflect on that now. I'm going to invite Deb to come forward. She's going to play a reflective song for us. The words are going to come up behind us. It's all about this topic. After that, I'm going to come and we'll have question time. And so we've got a few moments to reflect on these words. Although Deb is out, yeah. Joe, just going to go get Deb. Thanks. We're juggling kids. As you're reflecting on this, right, this is the question. Who do I serve? Treasures on earth or our ultimate treasure in heaven? Then I'm going to come back in a few moments and we'll have question time. No questions. Dave, you want to have a go? Don't have to, but shoot. Yep. So Dave's question is, being generous is good. Where should we be generous? Like, where should we give our money to? That's a good question. The Bible has a number of guidances for us. It doesn't give us specifics, but it says we should give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. So we should be paying our taxes and we should be giving to the church. There's two things. It also says, remember the poor. So we should be looking after, charitable organisations. And apart from that, there's not much more guidance you can give. So I heard a really good piece of advice once, which was spread it around. So don't give all your money to one organisation. If you've got, let's say, for example, $1,000, right? Give $100 to 10 different organisations, or give $200 to 5 different organisations. Give to CMS for missionaries. Give to Anglicare or the Salvos. Give to Christian Blind Mission. Give to Moore College. Give to your church. Give to another church. That was his advice, and I thought that was good advice, to spread it around as much as you can. The problem is, and this is my problem, is you need to make sure you're being a good steward of your money, and so look into the organisations before you give them their money. You don't want to be giving money away to corrupt or un-Christian organisations. So look into where you want to give it, and then give it to those various places. So the ones I mentioned are the main ones that Deb and I give to. Yeah, John. Sorry, should Christians invest in property? Yep. So good question. John's question is, should Christians invest their money? And I think the answer is yes. There's nothing wrong with investing money. One of the things I've recently realized is that God wants us to be stewards of our money. And what that means is we need to put our money to work. So I'll give you an example. Bill Gates, a couple of years ago, decided to give away all his money. But he didn't do it in one hit. If he gave it all away in one hit, that would have been about $40 billion. What he's done is he's kept that money invested and he's given away in chunks. And so over the last 5-10 years, he's been able to give away billions of dollars, but he's still got billions left to go. And so at the end of his lifetime, he's going to give away more than $40 billion because he's being a good steward of it. The question you need to ask yourself is, are you investing in money because that's where your treasure is? You want more stuff? Or are you investing in money to be a good steward of God's money to ensure you are not a burden on society or others when you retire? So that the more you earn, the more you can give away. But that's a really fine line to walk, isn't it? Am I really saying the more I earn, the more I can give away, or am I saying the more I earn, the more I can keep? So I think it is not wrong to be investing in money, investing your money, so long as it's not your God and it's not what you're pursuing. And I think 10% is the start of what we should give away. We should be giving away embarrassing amounts of money. Yes, do you want to follow up? And then I'll go to Jason. Yep. Yeah, well, getting a mortgage is putting you in debt, but it's actually putting to use the resources that are available to you. So you have a bank that has oodles of cash, and they're willing to lend it to you so that you can put that to work. That's what putting what God has given you to work, I think, means. You got to put your time to work, you got to put your energy to work, you got to put your money to work. And so it's a way of using the resources that God has put at your disposal, so long as you're using it for the right purposes, not to store up treasures on earth. Yeah. Jason. To the best of your abilities, yep. So you're saying, is it rude to check into where your money? Yeah, your money. I don't think so at all. I don't want to make a comment on what different churches do, but I think financial accountability is a very godly thing to do. If you're going to have closed books, that's a big problem. We have complete open books here at church. So if you come along to the vestry meeting, you will know exactly where every one of our dollars goes. And that, I think, is how you remain financially accountable. If you've got closed books, recipe for disaster. Satan loves that. So I think it is not wrong to ask a charity where their money is going. And most charities, I think, are pretty open with that. They want to be open. The ones that don't want to be open, they would be the ones I would be a little suspicious of and say, all right, well, I'm not getting my money. There's 1,000 other charities out there. I'll go find one that will tell me what my money is going towards. So, yeah. Another question. Matt. Yeah. right? The poor are getting poorer. The rich aren't getting poorer, but go on. Yeah. Yep. In how to treat money. Yep. Yeah. So Matt's question is, if we are getting, you know, if the stats are telling us that we're actually, comparatively speaking, getting poorer as a society, I don't actually see that myself, but it could be right. How do we treat our money? Now, on the front of your news sheet, I've written a little blurb about stewardship and about what good stewardship looks like. And I've said in there that throughout history, 10% has been the sacrificial amount. So that's why God in the Old Testament said, give 10%. That's the point at which people go, okay, I can feel that. I can feel 10%. Some people in Australia can't afford to give away 10% and still put a roof over their heads and food on their table. All right, so they need to think about that. Most Australians, though, 10% doesn't even put a dint in them. So I think you need to have a look at the situation you're in. You need to make sure you're not being a burden on others or on society, right? God tells us if a man does not work, he does not eat. You've got to get out there, earn money so that you can look after yourself. After you've got the basics, though, that's where you start to think, well, I don't. What am I treasuring? What am I pursuing? I'm pursuing his kingdom and his righteousness. So that's where I'm going to put my time and energy and money. I'm not going to put my time and energy and money into my comfort, my acceptance, my security, my power. I get that from God. I have everything I need from God. I want to start using my resources for others. And that's when you start, you know, if you truly have Jesus as your ultimate treasure, it will be easy to give away embarrassing amounts of money because we don't treasure it. But there is a line at which you move from looking after yourself to, making sure you have enough to making sure you have abundance. And that's the point at which each person has to figure it out for themselves. I hope that helps. Saskia. Yep. Oh, so are you asking, is it okay to? Yes. Yeah, that's what the Bible tells us to do. It tells us to, you know, carry your own burdens. Don't be a burden on others. Okay? Now, we can't control what others do. If others are a burden on us, we're told to love them. But for yourself, we're told to not be a burden on others, to make sure that you can have a roof over your head, have food on your table, and have clothes on your back. That the basics of living. But do you need a two-bedroom house in Earlwood or an eight-bedroom Parthenon in Earlwood? You know, that's what you need to ask yourself. Where am I spending my treasure? What am I pursuing? So that, look, when you put a line in the sand, it gets a little tricky, and I probably stepped over the line with that. But that's what you need to ask yourself. Yeah. Denise. Yep. Yeah, so Denise has asked an excellent question. What are the first fruits for the Christian? The first fruits were when you gave God your best. So Cain and Abel were set up as examples. Abel brought the first fruits. Cain brought the leftovers, the bit he didn't want anymore. And so the way I would say that translates to us today is we're not subsistence farmers. We trade with money. And so the first fruit in terms of giving is you sit down with your wage and you say, this is how much I earn before tax. I'm taking this much out for God. And that goes over there. Then tax is coming out anyway, but that's going to the government, and this is what I've got left. I think 10% is the starting point for the first fruits for Christians. And then you figure out, well, how can I be even more generous than that? And that's when you go up from 10%. So maybe if you are on a low wage and you're struggling to make ends meet, that's when you go, all right, what else can I give up? I cannot give up anything else. That's when you sort of say, all right, well, God doesn't want me to be a burden on others. But generally, the first fruits are, I'm going to sit down with my wage for this year and say, that bit is for God regardless. Start at 10%, then give your tax, and then see how much you've got. And if you've got much left over, you can say, well, I can give more than 10%. And I think that's the first fruits principle. I hope that helps. We might have time for one more question. Simon. Should Christians take out insurance, is Simon's question. I do. So, in some respects, you need to. You're not allowed to actually drive a car by law unless you've got third-party insurance. It's a level of prudence too, but you need to figure out, like, it's a really difficult line to draw, okay, as to how much insurance. So I don't have an enormous amount of income insurance, for example. What that means is if something terrible happens to us, Deb and I will just have to sit down and rethink what's going to go on with our finances. But we have car insurance, we have house insurance. So I think it's not wrong to protect yourself against, you know, it could be evil people, it could be accidents, it could be nature, so that you're not in a massive financial hole at the end. And again, there's a resource that God has given us, insurance companies. But you need to sort of say, right, at which point am I prudently protecting myself versus saying I'm going to find my security in life in my insurance or in my money? Like, that's my God. That's my idol. That's where I'm finding security. We need to make sure we are finding our security in God. So, yeah, I don't know how good an answer that is, sorry. Yes, but make sure you know where your security lies. Yeah, I think we should close there. Keep talking.